Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. I hope you enjoyed your 21-hour break. I am tanned, rested, and ready, and I see that Cyrus is at least two of those three things this morning. My number is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Tanned, rested, and ready. Should I identify which of those three you're not? Because two of them you are, Cyrus.
Sure.
You want me to just leave it as theater of the mind?
Okay.
All right. By the way, Cyrus, I do want to congratulate you. You've been talking about getting back in shape, and you know, I think that's something that, I mean, I and everybody listening probably should take to heart, no doubt about it. But you're doing it, man.
It's one of those New Year's resolutions.
You're hitting it hard. I really admire it. And Melanie took some cell phone video of you in the gym in shape. Oh. And I somehow came into possession of said video, and I posted it on Twitter. I don't know if you saw that yet.
But I'm going to Twitter right now.
Your workout routine is there for all to see.
That is not me.
That's not the word on the street.
Well, I'm trying to get into shape. You know,
I don't think that's the right way to do it, honestly.
I don't even know what to say about
that. Does your neck hurt?
It's a little sore, yeah.
It is a little sore.
My ego's a little hurt, too, here.
Mm. Well, I know what that means, and you're going to be scrounging for something to post about me.
That's exactly what I'm doing.
It's open season. Fair enough. You know, when Sam called yesterday, and he said, how about them dogs? I knew that this was some sports-related thing, and Sam explained it to me. Sam, I know you're listening, so automatic for the people. And if you've ever wondered why Sam says that or why I say that, because Automatic for the People was the name of an REM album early on, and REM, the band, hails from Athens, Georgia. So that's the connection. It's a bit arcane. So I knew that that was like, you know, what do they say down in Texas? Gig 'em or hook 'em or something like that. I'm showing my ignorance of college football. But in any case, I got a note here from Andy saying, Patrick, as a Georgia Tech graduate steeped in football rivalry with Georgia, with lots of family on the Bulldog side, although I could never cheer for the Bulldogs, I am happy for the Bulldog fans. As I look back at the celebration of the championship, like you have taught us, look for a God door. Right on. Andy says, whereas football is a zero-sum game, for every winner is a loser. For every winner, there is a loser, I think is what he means. God is neither zero-sum nor a game. Another difference is the celebration of a conversion is indeed celebrated in heaven, but the convert is given a cross, lots of grace, but a cross nonetheless. And the victory comes with strict rules. No gloating, no resting. Regenerate with prayer. I look forward to celebrating the real and permanent victory with Sam in heaven. Until then, I'm happy for Sam and all the Georgia fans. And that's Andy in Cottonwood, Arizona. Well, that's kind of you, Andy. It's very sporting of you, as they say. 888-914-9149. Cyrus, we can't get away from the clamor about the Taco Tuesday song, Uno Taco.
Uh-huh.
This came in from Javier in Albuquerque. And the subject is the Taco Tuesday song, Patrick Madrid Show. Thanks, guys, for playing the Taco Tuesday song. I called in early asking if it would get played or if Patrick and Cyrus for... Listen to this line. Tell me if this makes any sense in the world that we inhabit. He wondered if Patrick or Cyrus forgot it was Taco Tuesday.
Oh, come on, man.
Javier, what do you take us for, man? Of course we know it's Taco Tuesday. We know it's Taco Tuesday before it's Taco Tuesday.
Come on, man.
Yeah. I still haven't identified that one. Who's that?
Should I tell you?
Yeah.
That's Sarah.
Oh, that's Sarah.
That is Sarah. I got everybody in this building to do a come on, man.
So let's hear Sarah again.
Come on, man.
I can hear it now that you mention it.
Come on,
so who's
man.
Next? Okay, that's Maddie.
Come on, man.
That is Josh.
Good.
Come on, man.
That is our friend.
That was Scott.
From long ago.
That's right.
Okay.
And then,
come on, man.
That is, I know who that is.
The one and only.
That is John Morales.
That's right.
Okay.
Come on, man.
That is not Drew.
Nope.
Do that one again.
Come on, man.
Come on,
is
man.
Is that Garen? Is that Garen?
Nope. This is our, I don't know if I should tell you.
I'm stumped on that
I
one.
I think I like you being stumped. It's a little bit of power I have over you, and I got to hold on to it tightly.
Use it wisely.
That's right.
Who's next?
Come on, man. Come
that
on,
sounds like
man.
Josh again.
No,
that sounds
no,
like
no.
Josh again.
Come
no.
on, man.
Come on,
that's Josh.
Man.
Yeah.
I'm stumped on that one.
Okay, you should know this one.
Come on, man.
All right, you know this.
Oh, is that Kale?
That's Kale. That's right.
Okay.
Come on, man.
I know who that is.
Yeah, everybody knows who that is. What about this one?
Come on.
Yeah. Walk-ins are accepted.
That's right. So yeah. Who could
come on, man.
That be?
Hmm. Let's hear it again.
Come on, man.
That's your last one. You don't get any more.
Is that Mike?
Oh. No. Mm. Come on.
I thought
man.
He might be doing one of his voices.
Nope.
I don't know. All you right. stumped me with three of them.
I think I'm gonna let you sit on that. Call in if you know who that is. Call
Nobody
in
would know.
And you can I'll let you tell Patrick.
Nobody would know.
Everybody knows, except for you.
Well, okay. I'll keep working on that. Thank you, Cyrus. Come on, man.
I have to grab
888-914-9149. Lots to get to by way of emails, but I'd like to do a call or two first. Mark is up first listening in Alvin, Texas. Good morning, Mark. Welcome.
Oh, thanks for taking the call. I just want to know if you had commented on the Father Frank Pavone, you know, the laicizing of him. And he seems like a pretty – I mean, I guess I'm on the fence about it. I read articles about him being disobedient, and he says on YouTube he wasn't disobedient. Mm-hmm. And in the grand scheme of things, he seems like a pretty good priest. And we're, you know, it's a real confusing time that we live in.
Mm-hmm. No yeah, I hear you. So to answer your first question, Mark, or your question is yes. When the news broke, I spoke about that at length on the program, and I don't remember exactly how long I talked about it. Probably at least I don't know half an hour. But then that extended into questions people would call in and ask about it. So I would say a good part of the whole show that first day that the news broke, I talked a lot about it. So if you're interested in what I said then, you can go to the show page relevantradio.com/Patrick. And just put in the keyword Pavone, and it will zero in on probably right. First up would be that one show, and then you can listen and hear how I talked about it then. And so I'll just kind of give you a quick recap. What I said is, number one, I didn't know now Frank Pavone. He's going by Frank Pavone now, so he's publicly no longer using the title Father. And I mentioned then that although I had not known him well, and I hadn't, like, you know, we weren't pals or anything, I did know him, and we had a very friendly acquaintance. And when I would be at an event that he was at, or sometimes I would be maybe speaking at an event, and he might be there to attend, not because of me, but he happened to be there, like, at a conference. And we would have friendly conversations, and I have nothing but great admiration for all the important pro-life work that he's done. He's worked harder than many people in the pro-life movement, and there are many people in the pro-life movement who have worked very hard. So even by that very high standard, he stands out. And what I did in the aftermath of the announcement was simply share some news reportage from worthy sources that gave a kind of a background to the whole thing. And I referred people to the video that he had put out so that people could hear. Actually, at that time, he hadn't put out his video yet. It was still before that, and he had posted a timeline on his website. I guess it was at Priest for Life. And so I referred people to that so they could get his side of the story and so on. So that's kind of where we left things. As with anything, there seems to be more behind this issue than at least immediately appeared. So I want to give everyone the benefit of the doubt. I have nothing but positive things to say about Father Frank's, or now Frank Pavone's, work in the pro-life movement, as I said. So I'll just leave it where it is and hope that perhaps in due time something good will come out of it. I think that one of the real downsides is this syndrome we find ourselves in now, where if for any reason, it seems, if a priest who's deemed to be quote unquote Orthodox or quote unquote conservative or quote unquote whatever, if he has any kind of a scrape with his bishop, or if the bishop tells him to stop doing that and do this over here or whatever, there is now, unfortunately, I've seen a kind of knee-jerk, reflexive, almost Pavlovian reaction among some people to assume immediately that the bishop must be a scoundrel and that the priest must be a saint, and that the priest in question, because of his reputation for being conservative or traditional or what have you, that somehow it would be beyond the realm of possibility that perhaps he did something he shouldn't have done, or that he was indeed defiant to his bishop. And that's a real unfortunate situation to be in, if you ask me. And so for that reason, I just want to say what I know, say what I knew, which is what I just told you, and then leave it up to God. I wish Frank Pavone well. I hope he continues to do wonderful, great things in the pro-life movement, and I have no reason to doubt that he will. And hopefully this controversy will simmer down and people can get on to other things. That's my take on it.
Good take.
Well, thank you. That's the take I've got. And, you know, having seen this happen before, and one other thing I'll add, there have been some situations where, and I'll use Father Carapi. You remember him?
Yes, I remember him, yes.
Father John Carapi, okay. I'll use him as an example of what I'm talking about. My understanding and my sense is that the only adequate explanation for how he just vanished completely after his break with the church is that he reconciled with the church. I have every reason to believe that he did reconcile with the church, with his order, and so he's now doing a life of penance and obscurity, which is the right thing to do in a case like that. But let's use him as an example. When the story broke, however long ago that was, I knew personally people who refused to believe it. There's no way. He is a holy man. Look at how much good he's done. Look at all the people he's brought back to the church. Look at the stadiums that he fills. I don't know if they were actual stadiums, but he would routinely draw 10,000 people or more to some of his public talks. He was a magnetic figure, powerful orator, etc., all of the above. And I knew some people who absolutely refused to imagine that he had done anything wrong, and they assumed that it must have been the scoundrel religious superiors or the scoundrel bishop or the scoundrel whomever who was behind it persecuting this poor priest who was doing nothing but good. But little by little, all the details of the case emerged, and in fact, it wasn't like that at all. There were very, very good reasons why all of this came to a crashing halt, unbeknownst to virtually anybody. So I'll use him as an example. There are other priests who have sort of risen to the level of minor celebrities now because, you know, their cause has been taken up by people who are adamantly convinced that they are as pure as the wind-driven snow. I'm not talking about sexual morality here, but that they're that they're guiltless in whatever led up to them being told to sit down and be quiet by their bishop. So all I will say in this matter is take heed from the Father Carapi saga. Mm-hmm. There's a lesson to be learned there. That doesn't mean that every individual priest who's experiencing this type of persecution is guilty of anything, but not everybody who's being persecuted is innocent, even though it might appear that way. I think that's a lesson worth learning, don't you? All right, Mark. Well, thanks for asking. It's a painful topic to even discuss, and I'm sorry to have to even discuss it, but those are my thoughts, honest thoughts. By the way, just to bring to your attention, a great figure in the Catholic Church passed away in the last day or so, and that is Cardinal George Pell. I want to tell you just a little bit about him. He was Australian, first of all. He was the auxiliary bishop in Melbourne, Australia. And when he was there as auxiliary bishop, he was known far and wide as a quote-unquote conservative, orthodox man of the church. And so he was. I firmly believe that based upon what I'm about to tell you. But he was regarded with disdain by the, let's just say, liberal or left-wing Catholic clergy in Australia. And I had a chance to get to know him when I was on one of my speaking tours of Australia. And I don't remember which one this was. It might have been around, it was either in 96 or it was the early 2000s. But one of the first couple of speaking lecture tours that I did in Australia, I wound up at the parish where he was in residence as an auxiliary bishop. So he was an auxiliary bishop, but he was more or less cooling his heels as a pastor of a parish. Because, as I recollect, the bishop at that time of the archdiocese didn't really have much use for him. So there he was as the auxiliary bishop. He's the pastor of this parish. And I don't remember how this happened, but maybe the people who were setting up the lecture tour asked him if he would be interested in my coming over to say hello. And he said, yeah, sure. So I came over for lunch and I sat in his rectory dining room with, at that time, he was a bishop. And I think it was his chief of staff maybe. So it was Bishop Pell at that time and another priest and me. So we had lunch. It was very nice. And then the priest had to leave to go do whatever. And so Bishop Pell gave me, it seems to me, like a couple hours. And we went in the parlor. And I won't say whether or not we smoked a cigar or whether or not we sipped a little brandy or something like that. I seem to have vague recollections of that. But he was very hospitable to me, very kind. He answered a lot of my questions because as an outsider, as a foreigner, I didn't really know the church's circumstances in the local area there. So he was very generous with his time. And that's, I think, the only time I ever actually spent time in his presence. Subsequent to that, although not because of it, he wound up becoming the Archbishop of Melbourne, which I'm sure was a bit of heartburn for some people. And then he went on to become the Archbishop, he was named a Cardinal and made the Archbishop of Sydney, Australia. And all along the way, all the people that I knew who knew him testified to his probity and his the uprightness of his life. So even at that time, it was known that there had been some accusations made against him about sexual improprieties long ago when he was a priest. I think it was in Ballarat. And there had been a thorough investigation and all of the police forensics and everything that went into that, and he was exonerated. And it seemed as though this would come up again a few times. Well, fast forward to when, after Pope Francis had been elected, he had this committee of eight cardinals that he pulled together to be like the inner circle within the cardinals, the College of Cardinals. And by now, Cardinal Pell, he was one of them, and he was put in charge of finances. And let's get the Vatican finances squared away. Well, he was doing that. And by all accounts, and by the press reports that I read, he was getting really close to the problem and the problem people. Those who were squirreling away money, they were embezzling, they were, you know, all kinds of financial malfeasance that was going on in the Vatican finances. And he was like right around the corner from blowing the lid off the whole thing. And guess what happens? He gets summoned back to Australia to answer these charges of sexual abuse that had already been disproven. So he goes back. He's got nothing to hide. Yeah, I'll go back. He goes back. He goes on trial, and he gets convicted. And he goes to jail, which was shocking. And all of the evidence that was brought forth and all of the let's just say evidence, quote-unquote, against him was brought forward in court. And he got railroaded, if you ask me, and he was put in prison. He actually wrote a lengthy memoir, his prison diary, and you can read that. It's published by Ignatius Press, I believe, in two volumes. Powerful stuff. And I mean, if somebody's guilty of these kinds of crimes, he wouldn't do what Cardinal Pell did, which is like completely open up and provide this window into his soul and his life. But in any case, eventually the Supreme Court of, I think it was Queensland, that state in Australia, the Supreme Court reheard the case and unanimously overturned it. They unanimously said, This is bogus. This man should not have been convicted. He should not have been sent to prison. This so-called evidence is flimsy. It doesn't in any way convict him. And I talked a lot about that when this happened. So if you want to go, just go to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick, and type in the word Pell, P-E-L-L. You can find those episodes when I talked about this in much greater length. Suffice to say, his conviction was overturned. He was set free. And he's been sort of recuperating from that experience for the last few years, last couple of years, and he died. He was 81 years old. He had had an operation, and he passed away. So it wasn't expected that he would pass away, but he did. So please remember him in your prayers for the repose of his soul. To the extent that I could say that I knew him, and to the extent that I did know him, I was deeply impressed by what I saw. And when I dug into the accusations and the so-called evidence about what they claimed he did, it just seemed ridiculous on the face of it. And that's why I felt really good when the Supreme Court of that state in Australia reached the same conclusion. So that's what I wanted to tell you, is Cardinal Pell has passed away. Please remember to pray for him. I'm coming back just after this quick timeout. We'll take some more of your phone calls and some emails. And I read an email yesterday from a lady who really strongly disagreed with my explanation about the church's teaching on the Marriage Act. And she wrote back to me this morning and said she still doesn't accept my explanation and she wants some magisterial proof that what I'm saying is what the church teaches. And I shall provide that proof when we come back from this quick timeout. So please stay right there. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. This hour is sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Cyrus, you'd be happy to know, or maybe unhappy to know, that video of you I posted, I guess
it's not me.
Melanie took it in, of you in the gym working out.
She
it's now being
not.
Picked up by copycats on Twitter. Other people saw it and they're posting their own video.
Oh, well, good.
Yeah.
It's not me, though. For the record, just like every picture you've ever posted on the internet, none of them are me.
Well. If you want to continue to deny, what can I say? Let's go to Veronica now in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Good morning, Veronica.
Hi, Patrick. I just wanted to help you out with the voice that you didn't know who it was.
Come on, man.
Okay, so is that the voice in particular?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it was the one you didn't know.
Let me hear it one more time.
I'm going to give you a clue. I think you described this person as a voice that sounds like a cup of hot cocoa.
I think it's got to be Glenn.
Come on,
it's gotta,
man.
Yes, now I can hear it. Let's hear it again, Cyrus. True. I've been talking over it.
Come on, man. Yes, that's true.
That is Glenn. You're right, Veronica.
Nice job, Veronica. You,
well
Veronica,
done.
You were the first to call in. We had a few people that knew. You were the first one, so I want to send you a prize. So stay on the line, and Young Thomas will pick up with you and get your contact information. I'm going to send you one of Patrick's books, The Inquisition.
The Inquisition. Hey, by the way, Veronica, let's hear you.
What a show. The Inquisition. Here we go. We know you're wishing that we'd go away.
That's Mel Brooks.
But the Inquisition's here and it's here to stay.
Veronica, humor me and let me hear your interpretation of Come On, Man.
Come on, man.
Whoa, that's good. That's really good.
Say it again. I want Cyrus to do a hotkey of that.
Come on, man.
Oh, wow. That's really good. We got a keeper here. Thank you, Veronica.
Well, thank you for that, Veronica.
You're welcome. Thank you, Patrick.
No, stay on the line, Veronica. We'll get your info here. Patrick, you have to stay on the show, though. I don't know where you went. Uh-oh.
Everything's under control. Situation normal. We're fine. We're all fine here now. Thank you. How are you?
Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find out more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
Okay, we are back. Had a little gremlin action going on there for a few minutes. Thank you for your patience, but I'm back. Cyrus, stomp on that gremlin. If you can find him, just stomp on him. I don't want him back in the studio. I have an email here that comes in from Eric, listening in Minneapolis, and he's listening on our 1330 AM station, and he has a question about votive candles. He says, I'm really excited about the topic of votive candles because my hobby is wood turning, and I came across a how-to video on how to turn a votive candle. I'm listening to Patrick talking about votive candles and wondering if, in order to call it a votive candle, does it have to be blessed first? Tell me, and I'll be happy to send Patrick one. Or make Patrick one, just tell me where to send it. Well, that's very kind of you, Eric. Thank you. And our address here at Relevant Radio is in the contact section at relevantradio.com. So if you go there, you'll find the address. And thank you for your kindness. So yes, a votive candle is a prayer candle, or it's there to remind you of your prayers, or to remind you that you're invoking the prayerful intercession of Our Lady or one of the saints. And as a sacramental, it doesn't have to be blessed, but typically you would bless a votive candle or have it blessed by a priest. So if you were to go into your parish church and you'd see a bank of votive candles in front of an image of Our Lady, for example, almost certainly those have been blessed, and they're there for that purpose as sacramentals. So I hope you enjoy the newfound activity, I guess, of doing votive candles. Maybe that could turn into something that you can share with your parish and let other people enjoy the quality of your craftsmanship. Thank you for that, Eric. I appreciate it. Also, I just want to make sure. Yeah, okay. Just want to keep an eye on that phone there. 888-914-9149. Cyrus, you'll like this one. This comes in from Robert in Madison, Wisconsin just now. He says, this one is for Cyrus. Hi, Cyrus. I find it hilarious that you got everyone at Relevant Radio to give you a soundbite saying, come on, man. Can you play Father Richard Simon's version by any chance? Please and thank you.
I don't have Father Simon. So when I said everyone, I guess I was a little misleading there. I don't have his. Right. I'm working on it.
Okay.
I'm working on it.
All right. Well, there you go, Robert. Cyrus is on it. And yeah, it's really taken off, isn't it? Don, listening on the internet or on the Relevant Radio app, he wrote in to say, Patrick, love your show and listen every day on Relevant Radio's app while working here in Athens, Georgia. Just want to add another fact to the Automatic for the People. It's true, it was the name of an REM album, but they got it from the motto of a restaurant here in Athens called Weaver's D's Delicious Fine Foods, Automatic for the People. I'm not sure if Weaver D's is still in business, but thought you might appreciate that bit of trivia. Go Dogs. And that's from Don in Athens, Georgia, D-O-N. Don, thank you. Kind of you, indeed. I did know that, and I was familiar with the sign. It's a really old, kind of cool retro sign, and it hung for many years. I don't know if it's still there, but in front of the storefront or the front of the restaurant. So, yeah, I was aware of it, amazingly, but I appreciate you jogging my memory. Thank you for that.
I have an email, yeah. if that's all right. This is,
yeah, for sure.
This is from Steve in San Diego.
Okay.
So Steve.
All right, Steve Rolo, the Steve Meister, asking me questions.
He says, Dear Patrick, I was listening to your show as usual and just wanted to compliment you and your staff. You make your show not only educational and inspirational, but funny. How you interject humor and your staff plays a bit of levity with sound bites makes me smile. It makes faith digestible rather than shoving it down a person's throat. I am
well,
a
that's nice.
Yeah, this is really nice. I am a revert who attended Oral Roberts University 40 years ago. I was challenged when at required services we were saying the Lord's Prayer, and instead of stopping at deliver us from evil, they continued with, for thine is the power and the glory, amen. I thought, that is the doxology from the Catholic Mass. It was at this point that I started challenging many of my Protestant friends, and it was the springboard that brought my wife and my brother's family into the church. So back to why your show is so good is because at Oral Roberts University, when a person was too religious throwing scripture verses out, they would be known by the saying, your head is so high in heaven, you are no earthly good. You and your show have one foot on earth and one in heaven, keeping everyone listening and learning. Hooyah! Steve in San Diego.
That's really cool.
Yeah,
that's one. From Steve, huh?
Steve.
Thank Arono. You, Steve. Making copies. No, that's great, Steve. Thank you. And how interesting that something that you might think is just an insignificant little detail, that could be the launching pad for a discussion with people who would wind up becoming Catholic as a result. That's wonderful. I love stories like that.
Yeah, I like that. It's nice of him to mention the humor stuff because you can be Catholic and laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Both those two things are allowed together.
Yeah.
And I sometimes things get a little heavy and we forget to laugh.
Not me.
not me either.
I never forget to laugh. Not everything is a laughing matter. That's true. But thank you, Steve, for pointing out something that we've always thought was true here. And that is that a program that is attending to various really profound topics, after a while, if there's no... You know, if there's no levity or if there's no opportunity to have a little bit of lighthearted fun, then it can be ponderous. And we don't want people to go away thinking, this show is just too boring or anything. So thank you for taking note of what we're trying to do here. Appreciate that. So now let's get to the email from Fran. I read her email yesterday or the day before. I think it was yesterday, in which she, and I want to give fair warning to parents, we're going to touch again on this issue of the marital act. It's not appropriate as a topic anyway for children. It's not even really appropriate for, let's say, high schoolers, maybe seniors in high school. But below that, I would exercise grave caution and I would shoo the kids out of the room or turn the radio down for maybe 3-4 minutes, okay? Because it's not a topic that's suitable for children. Fair warning. Ready, steady, go. So Fran had sent me an email. And I'll summarize it by saying that her husband had now suffers from impotence because of, I believe it was a prostate surgery. And thus, she said that she didn't agree with an earlier commentary that I made in which I was explaining what the church teaches with regard to what is necessary in the marriage act. And she said that she and her husband do not follow what I was talking about, and said that it is, in her mind, it's permissible for, let's just say, completion in a way that is not sexual intercourse. And so I read her email on the air yesterday, and I responded to it and reaffirmed the point I had been making earlier. So I received this morning another email from Fran. So this is what she said. She said, Patrick, as a follow-up to the email you read, applauding you that you read it out loud, or read it aloud, I would like to know specifically, and that's all in caps, where it is that it is a quote-unquote church teaching that a husband and wife cannot engage in full sexual intercourse and cannot... I think I'm misreading it. Where does it say specifically that a husband and wife who cannot engage in full sexual intercourse cannot engage in any other sexual relation? Teaching as old as time, she's quoting me there, is not the answer. Please show us where it is. It's not in the catechism that I could find. Okay. So just to reiterate before I share from the catechism, what I had said was that, and maybe, Fran, perhaps this part of it, maybe you didn't catch this part of it, but what I said is that the husband and the wife have the right to enjoy physical expressions of intimacy And so if in the case of, say, impotence or for some other reason, sexual intercourse is not possible, they are still permitted to make use of many of the things that they would otherwise do as a sign of marital affection. So the church does not say that that has to stop. And I thought I had emphasized that pretty carefully yesterday, but I'll emphasize it again for effect. What I also said was that the couple needs to exercise caution so that those signs of affection that are precursors to the marital act, typically, don't wind up causing one or the other of the spouses to complete this activity in a way that is not the marital act. I'm trying to be somewhat roundabout, but I'm sure you understand what I'm saying. That's where the church says, you know, there's a certain line over which you can't cross, because if the husband or the wife or both wind up experiencing completion in a way that does not involve sexual intercourse, that's a serious sin. And I think that's the crux of your objection, Fran. So since you asked for information from the Catechism, here it is. And I'll begin reading in paragraph 2366, so you can consult it for yourself and verify what I'm saying. Fecundity, or the ability to procreate, is a gift, an end of marriage. Now, in this context, I'll pause for a minute. When it talks about ends of marriage, that means the goal or the purpose or what the marriage act is tending toward as its final goal, and that would be procreation. So fecundity, or procreation, is a gift, an end of marriage, for conjugal love naturally tends to be fruitful. A child does not come from outside as something added on to the mutual love of the spouses, but springs from the very heart of that mutual giving as its fruit and fulfillment. So the church, which is on the side of life, now listen closely, teaches that it is necessary that each and every marriage act remain ordered per se in itself to the procreation of human life. I'll read that again. The church teaches that it is necessary that each and every marriage act remain ordered per se in itself, or as such, to the procreation of human life. This particular doctrine, expounded on numerous occasions by the Magisterium, is based on the inseparable connection established by God, which man on his own initiative may not break, between the unitive significance and the procreative significance, which are both inherent to the marriage act. I'll pause there to say it in somewhat different wording. When it says it is necessary that each and every marriage act remain ordered per se to the procreation of human life, this means, I mean, it's clear what it means, but I'd like to expound on that a bit, that if in the intimacy of marriage, if the couple engages in acts that lead to this completion for the wife, husband, or both in a way that it would be impossible for the possibility of life to be procreated, that is a serious sin. That's what it's saying, is that if you have the right to enjoy this, but it must be ordered toward the possibility of procreation. And so I don't think I need to explain what that means, other than any other thing that might result in that type of completion that isn't a natural act of sexual intercourse would be forbidden. Each and every marriage act. Okay, so let me skip a couple of paragraphs, and you should read them for yourself. I'm not skipping anything that would change the context of what I'm saying, but paragraph 2367, 2368, 2369, these are all sort of preambles to the next part. So I'll begin in 2369. By safeguarding both these essential aspects, the unitive and the procreative, the conjugal act preserves in its fullness the sense of true marital love and its orientation toward man's exalted vocation to parenthood. Now listen closely, please, to this section. This is 2370. Periodic continence, that is, the methods of birth regulation based on self-observation and the use of infertile periods, is in conformity with the objective criteria of morality. These methods respect the bodies of the spouses, encourage tenderness between them, and favor the education of an authentic freedom. Now listen to this next part. In contrast, every action which, whether in anticipation of the conjugal act, or in its accomplishment, or in the development of its natural consequences, and purposes, whether as an end or as a means to render procreation impossible, is intrinsically evil. And you should read paragraph 2370, the second part of it, for yourself and ponder what it's saying here. Every action that renders procreation impossible, and that's what you're referring to. That's exactly the point that you're asking me about. You're referring to these actions that don't have as a possibility procreation just by the nature of these actions. And the church here in paragraph 2370 says that these actions, if they're deliberate, are intrinsically evil. Now, I don't want to put too fine a point on it, and I'm not trying to pile on or anything. And there's more in the catechism that discusses this more fully, but those paragraphs in particular, 2366 and 2370, are very specific about the question that you asked me. So I refer you to the catechism. I really do appreciate, Fran, your openness to this information. I realize that perhaps even now you don't agree with me, but hopefully you see that this is not just me saying, well, this is what I think it means, or this is how it's always been. In the catechism, you'll see that these statements in the paragraphs I just read to you are footnoted. So you can consult in the footnotes whether it's referring to scripture or a magisterial statement, etc. I hope that's helpful to you. I really do. Thank you. 888-914-9149. Moving on with some more emails, keeping in mind that you can call me if you're interested in talking. 888-914-9149. This comes in from Patricia, listening in California. And she says, she's listening in San Diego. She says, I know you're aware of this, but the last 2 days you have said that all a son or daughter has to do to enable their parents and relatives to attend the wedding is to fulfill the requirements of the church that it lays out regarding any necessary dispensations, etc. Well, let me pause there and say, what I said was that in order for the marriage to be deemed valid by the church, in the case of a Catholic party, a son or a daughter, the canonical form for marriage must be observed, which is get married in the church and have a priest, could be a deacon also, as the official witness to your wedding and to bless your wedding. And this is something the church requires for the validity of the marriage. And if a Catholic does not follow that, willfully, and this is not under some unusual circumstance like time of war or when there's no priest available for 6 months at a time, there are different provisions in those cases. But under normal circumstances, if the Catholic party does not seek a dispensation or does not follow the canonical form, that renders the marriage invalid. So continuing. But getting married in the church or with the church's blessing involves committing to marriage preparation, which can be anywhere from 6 months to 9 months, depending on the diocese. And there's a new proposal now from the Pope that it be a year. So for a Catholic young adult who wishes to do the minimum to please their parents, now must go on a weekend, attend several classes, perhaps take a computerized focus compatibility survey. While these have great value for encouraging successful marriages, the child who wishes to do the minimum will probably not see them as such. So it's really not as simple as just getting married in the church or receiving a dispensation to marry elsewhere. Well, okay, fair enough. That's true. But if the child is willing to undergo the marriage prep, it seems that it would be very likely that the same child would be willing to get married in the church according to what the church requires. And I guess the converse is also true. If a child is not willing to go through the 6 months or however many months it is in classes for marriage prep, they're probably not very likely to want to do what the church asks of them for marriage in any case. But simply put, when you boil it all down and you get right down to what specifically is the obstacle, what I was referring to is the obstacle. If they can work out an arrangement with the parish priest, and this can be done because the parish priest has the discretion to say to a couple, look, come and meet with me for an hour every other week for the next 6 weeks, or come meet with me for an hour every week for the next 6 weeks, and we'll do marriage prep together. And when I feel satisfied that you two are ready to get married within the church's requirement of a six-month waiting period, you can get married. So it does require some willingness on the part of the Catholic Party to do what the church asks. Now, I know from certainly all the phone calls that we've gotten on the program over the years that there are many young people who just don't care, and they're not going to do it regardless. And that's a real burden for you as the mom and for the family in general. So I understand the point you're making, and I appreciate that. Thank you, Patricia. Let's go now to who is this? Is Marie listening on the Relevant Radio app? She says, I asked my priest how long the graces of communion last. His answer is it depends on receptivity, life, sin, and God. There is no time frame. One communion can bless all of the time in one's life. And so she says, you said something like, as long as the substance of the bread or wine is there until digestion is finished, 10 minutes or so. My thought was that that is ridiculously small amount of time compared to how important communion is, and only taking into account the physical nature and matter, wheat, not the spiritual at all. All right, well, we have a misunderstanding here. What we have here is a failure to communicate, Marie, and it's probably my failure if I didn't explain it as well as I should have, so let me do that now. What I was referring to in the comment or question that I was asked the other day is how long is the real presence of Christ in the host? So we'll use the host as our example, as I did. That is not the same thing as the graces of communion. So you're conflating these two distinct issues. And as I say, it probably was my fault because I probably did a clumsy job of trying to explain it. So let's remember, first of all, that the graces you receive, the sanctifying graces you receive in Holy Communion, is not the same thing as the real presence of Christ under the appearances of bread and wine. They're related to each other, obviously, but they're not the same thing. I was referring to the church's teaching on the question, how long is Jesus there? If at the consecration at Mass, he becomes present under the appearances of bread and wine, so the characteristics of bread and wine remain, the taste, the texture, the color, the shape, the molecular structure, etc., all of those physical characteristics remain, but the substance or the reality of the bread and the wine have been replaced by the substance, the reality of the glorified, resurrected Jesus, body, blood, soul, and divinity. That's a formula that we Catholics tend to use because it's a compact way of explaining what happens. That's what I was referring to. So that real presence of Jesus, the church says, remains for as long as what is now no longer bread but has the appearance of bread remains as bread would be, with the inherent characteristics of bread. As soon as the body begins to break that down and it's no longer, properly speaking, bread, the church teaches that that's when the real presence of Jesus is no longer there. And if you stop and think about this and think about the digestive tract and the way that the human body deals with food, I think you can see immediately why this is an important thing for people to know so that they're not fearful or worried that the real presence of Christ remains in them longer than until the what once was bread begins to break down. So that's one discrete issue, which is the real presence of Christ. That's not the same thing as the graces of communion. So as long as you are in the state of grace, and for as long as you remain in the state of grace, which could easily be, for some people, for the rest of their lives, they may never fall into mortal sin again. The graces, the blessings, the sanctifying grace from that Holy Communion and all the ones that might follow it could last your entire lifetime, especially for one who is very holy and virtuous. So what the priest said is certainly true. There is no time frame. There's no set time frame. It's not as though the graces you receive from Holy Communion only last for 30 days and then they expire. No, not at all. What would cause them to vanish would be to fall into mortal sin, in which case you start over again. So do you see the distinction here? On the one hand, we're talking about the real presence of Jesus under the appearances of bread and wine. And in the other hand, you're talking about the graces that you receive from Holy Communion. They're two separate but related things. I hope that clarifies it for you. 888-914-9149. Let's see if we can get a call in here before we take our break. Let's go to Martin now in Chicago. Hello, Martin.
Hello, Patrick. My question is, can the saints in heaven pray for soul in purgatory, like a family member that recently passed away, and we say a rosary for that person and ask Mary to pray for them? Is that legitimate, I guess?
Yeah, sure. So the saints in heaven are perfected in grace and perfected in righteousness, as it says in Hebrews chapter 12. And St. James tells us in James chapter 5 that the prayers of a righteous person are very powerful. And that's referring primarily to us here in this life, but all the more so to the saints in heaven who have been perfected in righteousness. So their prayers are even more powerful by orders of magnitude than ours are in this life. So just as we can pray for the souls in purgatory, so can they. And the effects of their prayers for the souls in purgatory are even more powerful. So, okay. Simply put, yes.
Okay, great, great. That's all I had. I appreciate that.
You're most welcome. Thank you. I know that we have not enough time to take another call. So what we'll do is we will catch our breaths, we'll fall back and we'll regroup, and we'll come back to your phone calls on the other side of this timeout. The number to dial if you want to get in, you won't get a busy signal right now, which is unusual, but that could change on a dime. The number is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Your phone calls and lots of emails, including one here about Jehovah's Witnesses and what they believe about Jesus, straight ahead right after this.
I got a fever, and the only prescription is more Patrick Madrid. Come on!